Welcome to We Are Human Leaders. What does it take to create lasting impact, not just for a few, but for millions? Today, we are looking at leadership through the lens of global change and speaking to someone who is leading incredible impact in numerous arenas, including healthcare, education, and climate resilience. Luckily for us, he's written an incredible book about how. I'm Sally Clark. Today, Alexis Arna and I are speaking with Michael Sheldrick, a policy entrepreneur and a driving force behind the efforts of Global Citizen to end extreme poverty. As co-founder and chief policy, impact and government affairs officer, he leads the organization's campaigns to mobilize support from government, business and foundations. His initiatives have reached millions of people in over 150 countries and helped secure over $40 billion in support for local and regional organizations working to provide access to essential resources. Michael has worked with artists such as Beyoncé, Coldplay, Idris and Sabrina Elba, Lady Gaga, Miley Cyrus, Rihanna, and Usher, as well as an array of prominent political leaders. Today, he joins We Are Human Leaders to share his experience and expertise, as well as insight from his incredible brand new best-selling book, From Idea to Impact, a playbook for influencing and implementing change in a divided world. Let's dive in. Welcome to We Are Human Leaders, Michael. It's an absolute delight to have you here with us today. And before we learn a little bit more about your work, we'd love to start by getting to know you better first and the journey that's brought you to this point so far.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here. And thank you for having me on your podcast. Look, when I got started, you know, I'm known as someone who co-founded this organization, Global Citizen. We have 12 million members around the world. We've helped raise or mobilize $40 billion to help improve lives, you know, yada, 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 right? But people are always interested in why you're doing something. You know, one of my best friends says it's not what you do or how you do it, it's why you do it. And I guess from my perspective, if what you're asking is why I am passionate about these issues and social advocacy and social change, I guess it really goes back to my days growing up here in the northern suburbs, Perth, Western Australia. I live in New York now, but I'm back here. We have a four-month daughter, so I'm back here for a few weeks in Perth. And, you know, when I was growing up in the northern suburbs and I was at school, I was one of those kids that was quite shy, wasn't good academically, at least initially. And also was not great at sports, right? And in Australia, we love to idolize sports, but I was always that kid who just wanted to kick a ball in the straight direction, let alone score a goal. And lo and behold, yeah, with everyone watching me, it would fly off behind me. Everyone would laugh. And I would go into a school assembly. There'd be some great sporting hero talking about, you know, all the great stuff they'd done. And I'd be sat there thinking, well, how can I relate to this? What can I do? What can I learn from this? And, you know, it wasn't really until halfway through my first year at school where I had this fantastic teacher that for one reason or another took a keen interest in me and said, I think there's more to you than meets the eye. Up until that point, you know, one of my friends says that when people set so low expectations of you, you can live down to those expectations rather than rise above them. And for whatever reason, this teacher saw some potential in me that I didn't know was there. And he encouraged me to work hard, spend lunch times with him, go in that extra mile. And I never forget the last day of school. He had told me earlier, if I worked hard, he believed I could be number one in the class, right, for this particular subject. And the last day before school, I was sat on the lounge suite at home, car pulls up, and out rocks this teacher. And I'm like, what are you doing? Come into my house. And he said in a very Australian way, outstretched his hand, and he said, well done, mate. And he gave me this certificate with a number one on it. And, you know, I think after that, encouraged, you know, worked hard and ended up finishing high school in the top 1% of the state, could study anything I wanted. But as we say in Australia, I never really had tickets on myself. And so when people say, oh, you're doing really well, you've done all this, I never lost sight of that kid in the northern suburbs who felt like a loser, felt stupid, and felt like they wouldn't amount to anything. And I remembered the difference that teacher made in my life. And I think it was that awareness and that sense of gratitude, I suppose, for the opportunities I had grown up. And as I got into university, the recognition that there were millions of kids around the world who, through no fault of their own, maybe it's because they didn't have access to a great teacher, maybe it's because they didn't have access to quality medicine, so they died before the age of 5, let alone get into school. You know, I realized that that's what I wanted to contribute to, bridging those inequities and extending opportunity to people around the world. And that's really what led me to working in the social impact and purpose space.
Wow, Michael, thank you. It's incredible that such an incident at such a formative age in your life had such a huge ripple into your direction and really sort of, I guess, in a way, shaped who you are and what you're doing now and helping so many people around the world. It's incredible to think that that impact from one teacher who, you know, probably sees lots of students every other year was able to have such an impact on your life. That's such a special moment in time.
Yeah, and I say this, so it was very fortunate. So that teacher, he was like 24, would you believe? It was his first teaching gig. And he was only at that school for that 1 year. He went off somewhere else after that. And I tracked him down. So I'm back in Perth and I'm also...
I was going to ask.
Yeah. Well, it's important, right? And I think when you forget all these things, right? You forget where you've come from, been in New York for the last 10 years. So I'm coming back. And last night I did a book event talking about this new book. And I just decided to go through. I'd like... gee, it would be nice to be able to recognize him. And I went back to a number of people that played a role in my life, also a few lecturers at university, and I just invited them. And he came along last night, and it was amazing.
Oh, wow.
This was more than 20 years ago now. It's 2001.
Wow.
And so I told that story in front of everyone and basically said, you know, teachers do play a big role. And I don't know if anyone had ever told him that, but it is important. And yeah, that one incident really did change at least the course of my life.
It's such a beautiful and sort of simple story, I think, Michael, of how much impact we can have in ways that we might not even imagine, which also brings me to the title of your incredible new book, From Ideas to Impact, A Playbook for Influencing and Implementing Change in a Divided World. Now, this is a really big topic and we're really excited to sort of delve into it. You chose a really simple book there. Love to start by, I think first just for myself, just unpacking the title a little bit and sort of how you came to want to translate ideas into impact yourself and how you came to these ideas and sort of formed this playbook for influencing and implementing change.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I get people reaching out to me all the time, whether it's on LinkedIn or Instagram. It could be a university student. Quite often, it's even high school students. It could be members of Rotary clubs, you know, many different types of people. Sometimes it's leaders of communities in vulnerable situations. And they're all asking for advice on how to launch their own campaigns. And I suppose the reason why I wrote the book is initially when I would get asked these questions, and, you know, it would happen all the time. I'd be in Kenya. I was there on my honeymoon, and this young guy reached out on Instagram asking for advice, for ketchup, for coffee, and try and give some little words of wisdom from my own experiences. But initially, I always had this fear imparting advice, because in the same way that I mentioned to you, I was that kid, sat in that school assembly, listened to a motivational speaker who I couldn't relate to in any way. I didn't want to come across as, okay, look at all these great things we've done on social impact. And the only way you can create change is to found your own organization, bring together millions of people, because that in itself could be quite disempowering, right? And so really I was like trying to think through when I wrote the book, well, what is it that I know now, not just from my own experiences, but having got to meet some incredible people around the world, you know, some of the people who have endorsed the book include people like Jane Goodall, who's an extraordinary human being in the world. And what is it I've learned that I wish I knew, you know, 10, 15 years ago when we were starting out? And so I attempted to distill these 8 principles of what I term policy entrepreneurship, but it's really a way to make a difference. And my thesis is whether you're a cultural icon like Taylor Swift, or whether you're a business executive or an everyday citizen, is something we can all do. And I have a particular emphasis on policy change, because at the end of the day, yes, we need to volunteer. Yes, we can donate. Yes, if you're in the US, other countries, you can register to vote. But at the end of the day, with some of these big challenges like ending extreme poverty, climate change, they're systemic challenges, right? And so systemic challenges require systemic solutions. And this is why we need everyone involved in the policy process. And to your point on ideas and to impact, you know, one of the things that I identify quite early in the book is the fact we have this implementation crisis, right? We have all of these lofty words that our politicians have subscribed to, such as the UN Sustainable Development Goals, which was the UN 17-point plan that all countries agreed to in 2015 to end extreme poverty, reduce inequality, and address climate change. And yet, as of last year, which was the halfway mark to meet these goals through to 2030, as of last year, less than 15% of these goals had been met. And the reality is we're not going to overcome this implementation crisis by doing the same business as usual approach we've adopted in the past. We can't rely on government alone. We need all people around the table. And there's something we can all do in our spheres of influence to bring about change. And, you know, the book doesn't pretend to have all of the answers, but it does provide a starting point, right? Which I think is important. You know, one of the best things we can do is we can get people motivated to at least begin to create change. Often they get on that first step, you know, and then once they're on it and they start to see the payoffs of their initial action, momentum sets in and the rest is history. And, you know, I'll finish with a quote. One of my favorite heroes is Eleanor Roosevelt, who was the first US ambassador to the UN and also one of the authors of the UN Declaration for Human Rights. But I have this fridge magnet that I got shortly after I moved to America, and it's a quote from her. And it says, "The best way to begin is to begin." And so I hope the book will help many people get a start and to begin their own social change efforts.
Yeah, it's fantastic, Michael. And our listeners at We Are Human Leaders, you know, we really talk about leadership as a set of behaviors versus a formal role. And I love this idea that you mentioned. It's about mobilizing people at all levels, because we understand that once we have an idea of where our influence and power lies, we can actually take some empowered action towards that. So with that in mind, and you just mentioned this idea of an implementation issue as well, I'd love to unpack this a little bit more. And could you help us understand what are some of the most common mistakes that you've seen in your work, whether it be change makers or leaders, tend to make when it comes to wanting to drive the actual impact they want to see in the world around them?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's a lot I could comment on there. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll point to three. I think the first one is, you know, in a book I talk about if you're starting a change effort or even if you're collaborating in one, it's really important to have a very clear, concise goal of the impact you want to achieve so that people can visualize it, people can know how to support. And that sounds obvious, right? But too often I meet people and they're very well intentioned. And in some cases, they've already mobilized some support. Maybe they already have funding to launch a campaign or an initiative, or they have some high level supporters. But when I deep dive into the issue with them, often, you know, it's focused on the problem, right? So it's like, how do you stop illegal deforestation? How do you remove plastic from the ocean? And it's not actually a very clear concept at play in terms of the actual change they're wanting to bring about. And in the absence of that, right, no matter how intentioned you are or well-intentioned you are, really all you're doing is raising awareness about the problem. And there's no shortage of people out there ready to diagnose all of the multiple issues wrong with the planet, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's often to actually clearly define the solutions. And that could also be prioritizing the solutions at hand, because the flip side of that is I see people come in with almost too many solutions. And I call it the shopping list approach, where people get in front of someone and then they start reeling off like a whole page of like 100 different solutions. And so I talk through like, how do you actually identify some common solutions and goals and mobilize and know how to prioritize? I think the second key mistake I often see, and maybe it's less a mistake and more a distraction, to be honest, but one thing that I see very abundant right now in the world is the fact that clearly people feel anxious, right? And with that anxiety, there's a sense of powerlessness with everything going on around us, and sometimes even anger and outrage at its extreme. And I think when you don't necessarily have a sense of agency or a clearly defined path, you can look to ways in terms of how to channel that passion in a way that isn't the most constructive, right? And so I find people going on social media, whether it's posting solidarity messages of support, which is fine, but then extending that and policing the social media accounts of others and looking at what people are saying or what they're not saying. And all of that stuff, it might help us. You know, there's a great book out called Breaking the Gridlock that came out a few years ago. And the authors in that book talk about, you know, how all of that desire, solidarity posting, whatever you want to call it, can help us satisfy a need to feel right, righteous, certain, and safe, but doesn't actually help us impact people's lives. And so I think it's like, how do we avoid those distractions and actually channel into a meaningful, solution-oriented way, which is hard. And that's the role of policy entrepreneurs. And I guess the final mistake, I would say, and again, it's maybe a shortfall, is the idea that, okay, if you want to turn an idea into impact, turn talk into action, it's one thing to extract a commitment from someone or a promise from someone. But follow-up is so key. And I can tell you, you can have the most amazing meeting in the world, right? Where you get everything, or you think you've gotten everything you've wanted from someone or you want from someone. But unless you quickly follow up in a concrete way, chances are you're not going to turn that talk into action. And extended in the long term, right? It's just change often takes time. And too many of us in the social impact space ask ourselves the question, what can we win today, rather than asking us the more formidable question, which is, what can I build today that will last forever?
What a profound question, Michael. I think it does really take courage to have that longer term vision. You mentioned a couple of points there that I think really speak to this human desire that we have, whether it's to feel control in the moment through alleviating our own stress response by getting really intense on social media, or having these meetings and having this kind of like, yes, this win moment, and thinking that that's going to be enough, and then not having that follow through and really seeking the commitment for whatever reason. I think that's such a beautiful way of articulating where there's a bit of a missing link sometimes between all of this, your very well-intended activism, but actual meaningful change.
And the flip side to it, and by the way, these are good questions, and I've never actually thought about it in these terms, actually, but I break down the 8 principles into really 3 leadership archetypes in the book. Mm-hmm. And the first is the visionary, right, which addresses the challenge of how do you set meaningful, smart goals that can mobilize people around an idea. The second is the role of the diplomat, right, which is how you can engage constructively with people and recognize that change requires engaging with people we may not always like. And then the third is, how do you actually land the plane, right? This question of turning talk into action. And that's the role of the implementer. And in many cases, that might be one person who can at the same time simultaneously occupy all 3 of those archetypes. Or in many cases, it's about leveraging the strengths of other partners, right? And identifying your own strengths and weaknesses. I mean, I can tell you at Global Citizen, and maybe people won't agree, but someone asked me last night, they said, okay, there's 3 co-founders of Global Citizen. Are you all the same? Like, do you occupy the same space? And I can say, no, there's clearly one of us who's a visionary, one of us who's a diplomat, and one of us who's an implementer.
Right. And it's interesting that you mentioned that word, Michael, visionary, because when you were speaking about this goal part, for me, that's what was coming up. You know, often in business, we set a vision, which is very much this lofty idea of the ideal world that we want to be a part of. And it's almost the mission statement where we bring that down and the rubber sort of meets the road. Okay, what actual action needs to occur so that that vision can become a reality? And does that kind of sound a little bit like that goal setting moment in terms of the impact side of things as well?
Yeah, I think so. And it's also okay if when you're setting that goal, immediately you don't necessarily know how you will bridge the implementation gap.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what you want to be careful of is, You don't want to be manufacturing your goals by asking yourself too early on, well, what's achievable? Because what you can do is you can set a goal that isn't really inspiring or, you know, is just going after the low-hanging fruit. And so our goal at Global Citizen is clearly to end extreme poverty, right? It's a big goal. And that becomes the motivating force behind everything we do. But there was some advice. A friend of mine who used to head up Junior Chamber International, which is a service-led organization around the world. And he once spoke to me the power of naively audacious goals, right? And he said, if you come up with a very clear vision that you can communicate and rally people around, and you can get them to visualize the impact in their mind, the power of that goal can quite quickly overcome any implementation inexperience, any lack of access to power or funding or other networks. And it can bring people around who are able to supplement those shortfalls. And I can tell you, like, you know, now people look at Global Citizen and they say, wow, you work with all these big artists, you have all these big companies behind you. But that wasn't always the case. And what we had when we first started was literally what we wrote on a piece of paper. And that was the power of our goals.
Amazing. And you highlighted this a little already, Michael, and it's even mentioned in the title of the book that this is in the context of a divided world. Mm. I'd love to unpack a little bit what steps you see leaders can take to really start to foster some solidarity and create a united, cohesive approach when they're leading change. And, you know, I think for many of us at the moment, there's often a sense of sort of overwhelm, perhaps a sense of powerlessness or learned helplessness in this sense of, what can we do? Where do we start? You've identified very clearly, I think, a really beautiful way of sort of, you know, bringing that vision and then making it very, making tangible steps so we can create that change. But what do you think leaders need to do to really foster that sense of solidarity and unity as we move towards change?
Yeah, so it's interesting. In the book, I talk about this idea of pragmatic idealism, right? And to break it down, you know, I distinguish between pure pragmatism, which is maybe amoral, divorced from any kind of social purpose or goal, which can be pretty vacuous, right? But I talk about this tension often between, you know, having the idealism of our goals, but recognizing often if we're to achieve those goals, we have to get our hands dirty a little bit. And the road to achieving those goals might be a little bit messy. And we have to have a degree of comfort with that. And so, you know, a couple of instances I talk about in the book is the concept of change often requires mutual concession, right? And often, you know, when I was interviewing people who were involved in bringing about huge efforts in social change, an example being some of the negotiators that brought together the Good Friday or Belfast Agreement in 1998. To end the troubles that had long plagued Northern Ireland and the island of Ireland as a whole, which saw thousands of people, many innocent civilians die. And I spoke to some of the negotiators. You know, the thing that really came up is often a sign of an agreement is the fact that no party gets everything they want. And in that case, you know, there's still tensions, but they've had now more than 25 years of peace on the whole. But in that case, it was some hard issues people had to reconcile, one of which was prisoner swaps, right, or prisoner releases, where, you know, to one side, these were heroes locked up. To the other side, these were people being released who had been basically murderers of their friends and family and colleagues. And all of these compromises came together, but it was this recognition that this was what needed to happen in order to move forward. Right. And it was also a recognition that we're not going to move forward by resolving every past injustice in the past, but it's how do we focus on the future? You can't cure everything that's happened, but you can focus on the future. So that was one point, is the recognition of the importance of mutual concession. I think the second aspect that I talk about is this concept of the purity test. And Adam Grant, the Wharton Business School psychologist, calls this by another label. He calls it the binary bias, right? And it's desire to see the world in terms of black and white And the danger of this approach is, you know, if a person or a solution or an agreement or an organization doesn't 100% ladder up to our idealic view of the world, right? There is a pressure, especially now, from our tribe to basically say no, right? Mm-hmm. Subject everything to this purity test, doesn't ladder up, say no, and walk away. And I think the negative consequence of this is it can leave you, as I've said earlier, feeling right, righteous, certain, and safe, but without being willing to make any of the trade-offs, even in terms of engagement, when you're not going to have an impact on lives. And I talk about a few examples of this in the book. One of my favorite stories is the power of the environment movement in America, who really fought hard when the Inflation Reduction Act was passed a few years ago, which represented the biggest, most monumental piece of climate legislation in US history. I met with some of the key players involved in that to really find out, well, how did they do that? How did they bridge it together? And it told me some of the stories back in 2009 when President Obama was putting climate legislation forward. And he told me about how these environment groups really ate one another out, like they really attacked one another. You know, on the one hand, you had people who cared about protecting the forests, and then you had people who was working hard to get the economy to shift away from oil, coal, and gas. And some in that camp would look at those trying to plant trees, and they would accuse them of basically greenwashing. They would say, well, you're giving companies a get-out-of-jail-free card. You're allowing them to plant trees, and you're giving them a social license to continue operating. And as a result, this piece of legislation didn't get up. And this one guy I was speaking to, he said, we made a point that if the next opportunity came up to achieve major climate legislation, we wouldn't let it slip through our fingers again, right? So I said, well, what did you do in those 10 years in between? And he said, well, we got everyone together, the conservative groups that wouldn't even talk about climate change. And we got the groups, he said, even the crazy super lefty ones over here. We organized retreats. We even organized sleepovers. We got everyone together. And he said, when the next opportunity came up in 2021, 2022, he said, the coolest thing was we rocked up in Washington, D.C. with the most biggest diverse coalition ever assembled. We made agreements around what we were going to campaign on and what we weren't. And we each made our peace with that. And they secured passage, which when you look at forests alone in America, they secured billions of new dollars to plant new trees and to protect existing forests. And I think the result of that is to help protect more than 17% or the equivalent to forests to, I think it's something like will cover more than 17% of America's emissions and carbon footprint. And that's the power of coalition building. And I talk about that in the book, but it requires us to resist the urge not to subject everything to the purity test.
It's an incredible insight, Michael, and one I think that, you know, politically we can take so much from. But what I love so much about that and what I think we see so much of, you know, just at the moment in general sort of society, especially with social media, is just the rise of things like very binary biases, as you mentioned, and like cancel culture is a big part of this where we become so embedded in our own opinion, we forget that there may be other ways to move forward together in that mutual unity. And I think that's a really incredible example of how when we're considering our bigger vision for the world at large and the impact we want to have, we can actually consider how that can be won in unity alongside the mission and vision of others as well. And I think that's such an incredible example of coalition building towards a common goal, particularly when we are looking at something that's such a large undertaking as policy change. Imagine there are very few instances where without coalition, things like that would even get through.
I completely agree. And, I think partly it's because in the age of social media, I wonder if part of the issue is there's obviously loud minorities, right? And they have their voice and they tend to dominate everything we see with a certain view. And I think we often tend to think, those of us that might be afraid to express an alternative opinion or contrarian opinion, we're worried that, okay, 100% of the rest of the population thinks in a certain way.
Differently.
The reality
is
probably 95% of the population are in your shoes, wondering what everyone else is thinking. And it's only the 5% that's the loud minority. And I think it's getting over that hurdle. And I know when I've often expressed things and I've been like, how is this going to go down? People are often come up to me at the end and said, yeah, that really resonated. That struck a chord with me. And so I think partly it's how do we mobilize the courage? And again, you know, the greatest fear of resisting the desire to subject everything to a purity test is often allegations of betrayal and treachery from our own tribe, from our own side. And so that's often the biggest threat and the biggest hurdle that we have to overcome.
So true.
It's really interesting, Michael. I particularly admire, you know, there's a lot of courage that it takes and vision for someone in 2009, using the example that you gave, to be able to have the commitment and the vision to see through basically sort of 12 years of this process of creating a coalition and working to foster connections. You know, this is a longer term vision than I think a lot of us are sort of willing to take at the moment. We have, you know, whether it's political cycles or other sort of short term goals. So I just love the courage that it takes to be able to build incrementally towards that broader goal. Because obviously, in the eyes of history, 12 years is a very short time. And for us as humans, it can feel so, so long, not knowing, of course, the outcome at any time. You mentioned, you know, we need to really build and foster courage. I'd love to hear from you how you go about that.
It's interesting because I think it actually relates to what you were just talking about, right? With this recognition that change happens over a long stretch of time. And I think it's often first accepting the fact that you're not going to win every argument, right? You're not going to win every battle, and that's okay. Like I often tell people when they're starting with advocacy, right? You might be meeting with a local politician. You might be meeting with another NGO to build a coalition. I often say, you know, the goal of the first engagement isn't to convince them of the merits of your argument. If they're already sold, then fine. But it's not about winning the argument. It's about how you make people feel. And you want them to leave their encounter with you thinking, that was an interesting conversation. I want to meet with that person again, or I'm willing at least to consider this. That's always the point of the first engagement. And I think we lose sight of that, right? Too many of my encounters I've seen in the past with well-intentioned people, they get in front of someone they've been trying to convince, and then they unload everything. And you know what? That's the best way to ensure there's no second meeting. And that person walks up, well, I'm more convinced that I'm not going to support that person's agenda now, right? Because of that. Yeah. And so that said, you know, there's a number of different tactics that you can still employ to accelerate change, I think. You know, I think change can happen over a very long period of time, as you said, 12 years or even longer. But I think there are moments in time where we can always recognize that actually tickler idea, this is an idea whose time has come, right? And I think it's in those situations, there are particular levers and techniques we can use. Lenin had that famous saying, right, where he said there are decades where nothing happens, and then there are days where decades happen, right? And I think an example I talk about in the book, and this goes back several hundred years ago, but was around the social movement that occurred in the late 1700s, early 1800s, with respect to abolishing the transatlantic slave trade. Many of those movements had been going for quite a number of years, decades even. And it was all built on the strength of their moral arguments, and many of them on the strength of their Christian credentials or the idea that slavery is wrong and it should be abolished, right? And they had been doing this for years. They had gotten thousands of people to sign petitions. They had presented it in the British Parliament, and it hadn't really gone anywhere, right? And then a war started out between France and Britain. And in that war, it was interesting because there was some people in the campaign who basically was of the view, oh, we're never going to get any progress now because, you know what, given slavery is a big driver of the economy, we're now in war. if we're seen as calling for the abolition of that, we're going to be accused of sedition, of treachery. But then there was a couple of campaigners who said, well, hold on a second. Maybe we can actually use the war to frame this up and get things moving faster. And their idea was, well, why don't we put forward legislation basically stopping ships, right, with whether they're British ships or they're neutral ships, from trading with our enemies, right? And, you know, trading with Spain, trading with France. And in doing so, all of these people said, yeah, but that sounds like a good idea. We shouldn't be allowing, we control the seas, we should stop trade with our enemy, right? So they all passed this, not realizing that that included human slaves, right, as a good.
Brilliant.
So in that way, it was a backdoor entry into stopping the slave trade. And I think 1 or 2 years after that, you then had, in 1807, the formal passage of the end of the slave trade, but it really started there. And so there's a concept that I read about when I was writing the book, and it's called pulling the policy rope sideways, right? So many issues are polarized and divided, and it tends to be the more media attention an issue gets, the more polarized it is, and it's defined on one end of the spectrum versus the other. And the idea of pulling the ropes sideways, how can you frame something up in a different way and come at it sideways that isn't going to automatically throw something into, whether it's the culture wars or the political crosshairs of the day? So anyway, and there's a number of other ideas and tactics I talk about in the book on how we can try and accelerate change and, you know, not have to have something as fundamental as ending the slave trade take another few decades.
That's such a brilliant point, Michael, looking at these almost innovative ways that we can get what we're trying to do through, perhaps, you know, on the back of something else. And I wonder if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to ask you a bit more of a personal question here. And for anyone who's been in the activism space for a while, especially around certain challenges that really call on us quite emotionally, people who are working in the racism space, et cetera, a lot of these things can feel really close to home, and activism in and of itself can be a really big task in your own emotional labor. And I just wonder if you have any personal sort of strategies or ideas, Michael, around how you can take care of yourself as a leader, as a change maker, as an activist at any level. Perhaps how can you sort of keep your energy for the long term in these sort of situations to make sure that, you know, change that does take a long period of time to really come about, we can feel like we can sustainably go the long haul in seeing that through.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked this question, because it's a real issue in the social advocacy, the nonprofit, and really the charity sector as a whole.
Yeah.
And I think in part it's a problem of our own creating. You know, I think we almost put the idea of the charity or the nonprofit worker on a pedestal, right? And we've almost expected this person to be this incredibly selfless, you know, person, like who is a saint, who is happy to, you know, put themselves through, you know, like earning minimum wage, the idea that we're not going to do anything for profit, that we're not going to do anything to take care of ourselves. You know, the concept of self-sacrifice is a huge, huge part of that. And, you know, I think in part, like already nonprofit workers have sacrificed a lot, right? Or those even volunteering their time who don't get paid, there's many people who contribute to that. And the challenge with that is, I mean, that will always be an element of it. But the challenge of that stereotype is it's almost become a requirement. And it's like if people don't fit that mold, we're actually told to shame them or tear them down. So we get to the point, you know, and a great writer in America, he wrote a book called Uncharitable a few years ago, and he was kind enough to give an endorsement for the book. He talks about this concept of the overhead myth, and he talks about the idea that there are plenty of people who donate to charities, but we often make this comment, oh, well, I want 100% to go to the program, right? And we don't ask ourselves, well, who is actually delivering the program? And it's people. Right? Well, you know, we should be making sure those people are rewarded, that they're looked after, that they're paid, right? In the private sector, we make sure people are looked after, they're incentivized. And he points out, he gives these two contrast in analogies. He talks about, on the one hand, a charity worker, the head of a small charity that might be earning, let's say, $100,000 a year. And this person is expected to raise, you know, let's say a budget of $10 million a year. They have a small staff. And because of these restrictions on overhead, et cetera, they're not able to pay other staff competitively. And they're in this vicious cycle of trying to attract talent, dealing with burnout, and trying to raise $10 million. And it's just so hard. On the other hand, there's an alternative reality where that same worker goes to work in the private sector. They apply their, let's say, marketing skills, and they earn a salary of $400,000 a year. Well, that same person could then donate $100,000 of their salary to that nonprofit. They get to sit on the board, and they get all the glamour and applause that comes from being labeled a philanthropist, right? And so if you're looking at this and you're trying to give people a value proposition or a convenient offer, you're like, oh, okay, I know which one sounds pretty good, right? And so the question is how do we as a society, you know, all those issues you alluded to, how do you take care of yourself? Well, it really also starts by making sure that society, philanthropy, actually properly values that work and assesses that work. Because, you know, it's great to do that for a few years, but if you've got family and everyone has their own family life, we all have our own challenges, how do you make sure that you're properly paid, that you're properly looked after? I mean, it's so important. In the book, I talk about how we rewrite the rules of philanthropy to make sure nonprofit workers and advocates are better valued in society, in the same way we value increasingly better, but we need to obviously value more as aged care workers, teachers, nurses, etc. Like, this is something we can all be doing.
Yeah.
So I know your question was about, you know, how you can take care of yourself, but this is also about how the organization and the broader philanthropy ecosystem can also take care of you as well. And we shouldn't just say, oh, I don't want to pay any overhead, because often that overhead is actually these very individual heroes doing this work. But I think, to answer your question, how we can take care of ourselves, I really think it's staying true to your true north. I think, you know, too often we fall into the trap of feeling like we have to do everything. I know I've fallen into this trap before, where you start doing something and then everyone starts reaching out to you for advice.
Yeah.
And you feel like a bad person if you don't respond to each and every one of those requests. And it's okay to say no. Or it's okay to say, I really want to meet you for coffee and give you advice, but hey, I'm doing this thing right now and it's really stressing me out. Would you mind if we did it next time you're in town?
That feels like a reminder.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I love that.
Exactly. Yeah, such an important point. And as a burnout researcher myself, Michael, I think it's something that we often forget. And it's particularly, I think, in that space where there's almost an expectation that you will accept the glory of fighting for something better in lieu of a livable salary. And these kind of payoffs that people in the charity and the not-for-profit sector are expected to take. And I think there really does need to be a real shift in the narrative around how we value human input and how we value what we do and what other people do. And certainly couldn't agree more with your statement that also nurses, teachers, like the one that inspired you, these people who really do deserve to be, you know, financially remunerated in the way that they truly deserve, given the impact that they have on humanity now and today and tomorrow.
Yeah.
Now, I feel like, you know, we have a million more questions, but we also really honor your time and don't want to take up your entire day. We'd love, though, to just sort of finish with a little bit of an insight, because I know there's a lot of people listening who will be very inspired right now to want to make a change and to start to translate perhaps an idea that they have into impact. What would you advise as a first step for that person listening right now, Michael?
I think it's twofold. I think the first is to, you know, really identify that cause. You don't have to necessarily have a goal in mind. And in my book, I talk about how to identify other networks of people who can help you flesh that out on how you can come and identify a solution. But it's really important to identify what cause it is you're trying to address. And then I think in the most authentic way possible, really drill down on why you're passionate. Because I think when you get in front and you start asking people for help, you get in front of people, they'd be looking at you, unless they know you really well and they already trust you, that's fine. But otherwise, many people will be looking at you with a glazed look in their eye, sort of trying to figure you out. And they're like, well, why are you here? Mm. What does this mean to you? And I always find unless people understand why you're there in front of them, you have a credibility issue. And until you can bridge that, it's going to be very hard to attract the support. But if you know your cause, if you know why you're doing it, then from there, you can quite quickly start to build support, convince people to come on board. I think that's so incredibly important. And it's okay too, and this is probably the flip side, to also identify what your shortcomings are and where you need support. You know, write it down. What's my cause? Why am I doing this? And then what don't I know? I remember one of the very first campaigns I did. It was to mobilize support alongside Rotary International to help eradicate polio. And I remember I knew why I was doing it because I'd met these Rotarians and they were incredibly passionate. I'd met polio survivors. And I also thought in eradicating the disease, it was one of the best ways we could demonstrate to people that the end of extreme poverty was possible. So I knew why I was doing something. But I remember having all of these doubts. I don't know where we're going to get sponsorship from. I don't know where we're going to be able to meet if the key decision maker is the prime minister. How are we going to meet with her? And I remember just writing up this list and then ringing a friend. And through that, one thing led to the other. And, you know, as a case in point, this was Global Citizen's first ever music concert. We had no artists, no sponsorship, no venue. I'd never performed anything in my life. And by just putting that out there into the world, saying, this is my idea, how do I do it? I remember sat at a park bench at my university and getting a phone call. And it was this American lady. She'd met an Australian while surfing in Hawaii. And then they had moved to Queensland. And there she was bored trying to figure it out. And someone had forwarded her this email because she had worked on producing benefit concerts in America. And she said, well, wow. I can help you out. I've got some advice. And, you know, I think what I talk about in the book is how to leverage the power of others. Because at the end of the day, you know, no one can do everything, but everyone can do something. And I think the key is to first ask yourself, well, what is it that you can do?
And it sounds to me, Michael, that you've seen a lot of success through this clarity and conviction around the importance of your why. And that in of itself has given you the confidence to navigate the how. We don't need to know that right now, but we know why this is so critical. So we'll find a way.
Couldn't agree more. If you can come up with the why, the how will usually take care of itself, even if you don't know the journey. If you can get the destination, then often the rest will take care of itself, which is why, again, full circle, Eleanor Roosevelt, you know, the best way to begin is to begin, even if that is as simple as reaching out to someone, writing an email, sending a text message saying, hey, would you know how I could raise money or get a venue? Do you know how to do this? That's often the best way to begin. And one thing I would say is people are constantly afraid of reaching out to folks because they're worried of rejection. And you just need to break through that. And it is hard. And chances are the first couple of people you ask for help will say no. That will likely be a given. Chances are they may not even know how, but persevere, stay with it, because it might be the fifth or the sixth person. And even that person might say, I can't help you, but I think I know someone who can. Yeah. Just stay with it, because eventually you knock on the right door and there will be someone who will see the clarity of your idea and be able to help.
A very inspiring and also energizing note to finish on there, Michael. Thank you so much for being with us on We Are Human Leaders. It's been an absolute privilege to sit down with you today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for joining us at We Are Human Leaders for this incredibly important and thought-provoking conversation with Michael. You can get a copy of his book and learn more about his incredible work in the links in our show notes. And of course, learn more about human leadership at www.wearehumanleaders.com. Thank you for being a part of the journey. We'll see you next time.